Welcome back to An Owner's Guide to the Mind. I'm Patrick Healy.
And I'm Mike Smith.
We're delighted to have in the studio today Dr. James L. McGaugh, Research Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior in the School of Biological Sciences, right here at the University of California, Irvine campus. And he's also a fellow of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a long-term founder, I would say, of the field. Well, in fact, Dr. McGaugh is a founder. He was a founder of the School of Biological Sciences and its Department of Psychobiology as its first chairman, an innovation at the time, probably still is. And he founded the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory. And perhaps the most important one is that he is one of the primary founders of the field of modern neurobiology. He came not very great distance to be with us today. I think it's Dr. McGaugh's office is in the center, and we share a parking lot with KUCI here. And so here on the campus of the University of California, Irvine. His latest book is one for you listeners, one I think that you will, listeners of this program, would be a good read for you. And those of you who want to learn about memory, it's called Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories. Dr. James McGaugh, welcome to An Owner's Guide to the Mind.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come here.
It's our pleasure.
You know, it seems that your book, Memory and Emotion, is an exposition and a very interesting discussion of your work in neurobiology, up to the time of its publication, at least. And I remember discussing some of these exciting ideas with you a few decades back. If I remember correctly, you showed that a rat could learn a maze, receive one of several drugs, and increase its learning of that maze after the fact. And I think that was one of the first instances demonstrating memory consolidation.
Yeah, how has that work held up, and how have you followed up on this important finding since then?
Well, it certainly has held up, or I wouldn't have written a book about it.
Good thought.
And I have to say in defense that the book is not about my own work, unless it's thinly disguised. I thought it was a little bit more than that, but it built on it. I'd like to tell you how it got started, and it got started when I was a graduate student at Berkeley. When I discovered in the literature that it was possible to destroy recently formed memories by applying electrical stimulation to the brain. This was discovered because ECT was used in humans and these experiments were done in rats. And I got the idea that if that's the case, it should be possible to enhance memories as well as destroy them if I could do something to the brain to make it work better for a period of time shortly after learning. And my research advisors at the time told me something like, forget it, it's stupid, it's a terrible idea, go on with other research. But my main advisor took a sabbatical leave in Norway.
That's the way to do it.
Right at that time. And so I took advantage of that, and I did the study. And lo and behold, the drug that I gave after the animals had been trained to do something enhanced their memory of that, and that set the stage for, I have to say, all of my research in the subsequent years, because what I'm trying to do is to discover what goes on in the brain when that happens, and also why does that happen, and what processes in the brain ordinarily do what the synthetic drug that I was using did. So that's been my quest.
It's really, it's a fascinating idea. I was fascinated then and still now. The idea that you can improve your learning of a task after you've actually finished running the task, after the learning period is there.
Yes, and in a sense, that's what this book, Memory and Emotion, is all about, because what it says is, unbeknownst to us, that's what we always do. That is the way the brain works. That's the way it takes care of things, so that we don't have to make note of something that's very important. Somebody is embarrassed. We don't have to say, I was embarrassed. I want to be sure that I was embarrassed, so that when I face that person again, I have to rehearse that. I was embarrassed by so-and-so. No, you don't have to do that. You're embarrassed. You automatically remember that experience more strongly than other events of the day, so that that will guide your future life. You will try to do things in the future to avoid the embarrassment, or you may, if you're evil-spirited, want to retaliate,
exactly.
Whatever happens come to mind. But that has enormous adaptive significance, and this is something that the brain evolved to do very early in evolution, very early.
You know, some of those situations you talked about, I was thinking when I was thinking of this show and this interview that we were talking about, of hyper-learning or hyper-memory. This is things like trauma. It could be things like pathological memories or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where the memory is so overpowering that it turns into a pathology.
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that until recent years. I was just trying to figure out how the brain works. You know, something simple to begin with, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out what goes on in the brain when this happens. What brain systems are responsible for this? What's the role of stress hormones in this? And we've learned a great deal. We know an awful lot about the sequelae of an emotional arousal and the subsequent processing in the brain that lead to the development of a stronger memory. That is really what we have learned a great deal about. Well, one day a few years ago, I got a call from a psychiatrist at Harvard, Roger Pittman, whom I did not know, and he did not know me, and he said, I've been reading your stuff, and I think it's relevant to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'd like to talk with you about it. And I said, well, sure, I'll get out my calendar, and I'll figure sometime. He said, no, I'm coming tomorrow. And he arrived in my office the next day, and I had him give a little seminar, and then we talked. And he explained the following to me, which I did not know, and that is that post-traumatic stress disorder does not develop instantly following a trauma, but it develops slowly over a period of time. And his view is that the sequelae is as follows. You have the trauma, and then, which of course makes for a strong memory,
yes.
And then after that, the next day, the person will inadvertently rehearse that trauma. It's called flashback. It'll flash into their mind. There's nothing you can do about it. It just pops in, and they try to repress it, but it pops in again. Now, every time it pops in, it's a rehearsal. Everyone is a rehearsal.
It's a relearning.
It's a relearning, yeah. And with every relearning, stress hormones are released, and our research shows that stress hormones are the key culprit in making memory stronger in any case. So what you have is this system going awry by the constant feedback. It's just you have the rehearsal of the trauma, the memory gets stronger. Rehearse it, it gets stronger. And the idea was then that if this could be damped, then PTSD would not be eliminated, but its growth would be attenuated. It's a very different idea. It would be sort of prevention of PTSD by disabling this automatic system that ordinarily goes into play.
Sure.
Now, we had shown that there are drugs, commonly used drugs, beta blockers, which are used for heart disease to prevent the heart from working too hard when adrenaline is released in the body. We had shown that beta blockers will prevent the action of this system. That is, we can shut off this correlation between the significance of events and the remembrance of it if we put beta blocker into a particular brain region. We knew that already. So I said, fine, what I'm going to do is put beta blockers in humans, and the doses ordinarily used for heart disease,
yeah.
Low doses, well tolerated, and I'll just keep the subjects on that for 10 days, and I'll test them 2 months later for signs of PTSD. So he rounded up a lot of people who've been traumatized in the Boston area. Apparently that's not too hard to find in the Boston area.
I understand that. Yeah.
And put them on beta blockers for 2 weeks and then looked at signs of post-traumatic stress disorder 2 months. And lo and behold, there was a significant decrease in the signs of PTSD.
That is remarkable.
And this study was then replicated by a French group obtaining basically the same finding. So this is in a sense, a validation of his extrapolation of our findings to apply it to post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's the same thing. We're talking about how strong memories are made using this biological system. And he said, yes, and those strong memories can also go awry if this system is, you know, put into overdrive.
That's right.
Sure.
So we're actually talking in that particular circumstance, the PTSD and the drug treatment, the beta blocker treatment, was actually after the initiating trauma.
After the initiating trauma. And it's completely unlike other treatments for anxiety disorders, the drug treatment for anxiety disorders, because there, what one is trying to do is to attenuate the anxiety that's there. So a benzodiazepine or a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, something of that kind. And they, the SSRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, are moderately effective in dampening the anxiety that's associated with PTSD. As a matter of fact, those are the drugs of choice that are used by biological psychiatrists.
Usually known as antidepressants.
Right, for antidepressants. But this is a different notion.
Yes.
It's a different notion. Take it for 10 days after you've had the trauma, and that's it, you see. And that, what it does is dampen the development of it, according to his theory and according to the two studies that provide evidence in support of it. This is a new idea.
It is. It's certainly not out there in the clinical area.
I got a call yesterday from the Chicago Tribune writer who wanted to talk about this. And then he said, well, tell me why it is that it's not in common use in the Chicago area.
That was my question.
Yeah, I've called Northwestern. I've called University of Chicago. I've called University of Illinois Medical. They're not using it. I said, well, there are lots of reasons for that. First of all, most people know that the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the anti-anxiety drugs, are somewhat effective in dampening the symptoms of it. So that's number one. Number two, most people who see PTSD patients do not get fresh ones. They get people who've been around a long time, including World War II veterans who still have PTSD. And this kind of treatment is totally ineffective for that. You got to capture it in the process of being made, not when it is fully blown. So that's another reason for it. And a third reason for it is that both of these studies that have been published are small sample studies. And so the conservative thing to do when you see small sample studies is wait until the big ones come around, and then you'll decide. And the big ones are coming around because very large-scale studies of this are underway at a number of institutions. Why? Because if this turns out to be effective, it will be a very cheap way of dealing with it.
Absolutely.
Because these things cost practically nothing, and it's a two-week course, and it's over with. And besides that, we are now, with the very astute management of our government, developing very large numbers of PTSD patients coming back from Iraq.
Of course.
And the latest news I got from a psychiatrist at the VA, where I was lecturing in Texas not long ago, is that if the veterans participated in both of the Iraq wars, there's an over 30% incidence of PTSD in those patients.
Wow.
And as most people know, that some people who have post-traumatic stress disorder will resolve the disorder over time without any treatment at all. But there is a lingering percentage ordinarily thought of in the usual population of about 5 to 8% of people for whom it will not resolve. I mean, that means the rest of their lives. That's what that means, that when it doesn't resolve. And if it's 30% at the get-go, then that's going to resolve maybe down to 15%. And when you think that we still have World War II veterans and Korean War veterans and Vietnam veterans who have PTSD, that is a big problem.
It is indeed. It's interesting. One of the things I was thinking about in terms of deciding whether to give this treatment, which you could give it with everybody, is not everybody who is exposed to a traumatic situation gets PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. But with a 10-day treatment of a relatively benign substance, it probably is good to do with everybody.
Well, this is not like deciding whether you're going to do open-heart surgery
somebody
has trauma or brain surgery.
It's minimally invasive.
Yes. Now, I have to say, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a physician. I don't give these drugs or prescribe them. And so I'm in no position to say it's a good idea or not to do it. I just say on scientific grounds and on pharmacological grounds, I can't imagine why one would not want to cover the possibility. You know, in the same way where somebody is exposed to flu and now they're going to take Tamiflu.
Yes, right.
Well, what percent of the people who are exposed to the flu are going to get it?
Exactly.
And so take a little Tamiflu. In this case, at least I think that psychiatrists would be should be interested in thinking about the possibility of preventing PTSD with this pretty benign sort of, sure. Yeah. of treatment.
Well, and they've done that with as you point out, the SSRIs, which yeah. are primarily for depression and anxiety, but they're using it now for a whole range of psychopathologies.
And they have side effects.
That's right.
And they can develop dependency and things of that kind, and those things are not known for the class of beta blockers that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. I'm not here to sell beta blockers.
No, it's
because I have, let me have a disclaimer, I have no investment.
Oh,
and,
yes?
And furthermore, there, I, as I understand, there's no money to be made. Maybe that's another reason they're not
that's
being,
the problem.
There's no money to be made because they're all off-label.
Wow. You know, this is a wonderful, first time I've heard of this application of drugs for psychopathology and in a very different way. In other words, you're not ameliorating symptoms that are already there. You're preventing the yeah. consolidation yeah. of those memories which yeah. would reinforce, positively reinforce yeah. to
see, I'm still trying to get my brain around how exactly that happens.
Yes.
So I have a trauma. It naturally recurs to me over and over again. You're calling it rehearsing itself again and again. I develop a system of reactions to those rehearsals and I guess to the original trauma.
Including
well.
A stronger memory of the trauma.
Yes.
Each time it's a stronger memory which builds anxieties, builds yeah. other either physical or emotional yeah. symptoms. And you're saying that these beta blockers actually, when introduced early on, prevent that yeah. snowballing effect.
Yeah. Let me explain why, because we skipped that part of the...
Well, that's where my brain's getting hung
yeah,
up.
Yeah, we skipped that part. So here's
you
what
you
two
doctors are talking. We listeners don't quite
all right,
understand
here,
all that stuff.
We learned, and I say learned meaning over several decades, very intensive research by a huge number of graduate students and postdoctoral researchers and visiting scientists in my lab. We learned the simple thing that stress hormones that are released by emotional excitement, and the two major stress hormones are adrenaline and corticosterone or cortisol in humans. Corticosterone in rats, that's what we usually work with. So cortisol is released from the center part of the adrenal gland, which is located next to the kidneys, and goes into the bloodstream. Adrenaline is also released in the bloodstream. Those are two stress hormones that are activated by the emotional experience. Right? They then activate both indirectly through neural pathways and directly in the case of cortisol by passing into the brain. They activate a very specific region in the brain called the amygdala, which is Greek for almond because it's an almond-shaped structure bilaterally in the brain, in the middle part of the brain underneath the temporal lobe. So if you went in right where your glasses, the temple of your glasses, you go in and to the middle of the brain, you'd find these two structures, the amygdala. This gets turned on then directly by emotional arousal, and it gets the booster shot from these adrenal hormones. That's what happens when somebody says, "You're fired. I love you. What a jerk you are.
Here comes a bullet.
Here comes a bullet. Here comes a bullet. My yeah. God, they almost killed you." Right. I mean, that's the kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
But it could be the whispering, "I love you," in the ear could do it. I mean, it's not – you can't identify it by the stimulus. You have to identify it by the reaction which it produces. Right. Then, so we learned that. That only took us 30 years to learn that. A very complicated process.
Slow learners? Is that right?
Yeah. Slow learners of a fast learning system. So then we learned that what this structure does is to serve as an amplifier. When it is turned on, memories of events are being stored wherever the brain is activated and wherever those circuits are. And those are probably very widely distributed for any kind of an event. This little structure is more interconnected with other brain regions than any other brain region is connected with other brain regions. So imagine it's sitting there as a central device that is connected with everything else in the brain.
Right.
So when it gets turned on, it sends out messages to those other regions of the brain that say, in effect, "Hey, I got turned on. Something very important happened. You're in the business of making memories. Make a stronger one." And it does it by, we believe, activating presynaptically to promote more changes in the connections that are taking place in those other brain regions, and there is physiological evidence that supports that general view. So that's the overall thing. You get excited about something, hormones are released, the amygdala gets turned on. The hormones go to the amygdala, say, "Turn on more." The amygdala, that is blind and deaf and dumb, says, "Hey, I'm excited. everybody go to work. Do what you do.
Yeah.
And the go to work means when it sends out the signals, the memories get stronger and the whole process is automatically. Now, we can disconnect this system by giving beta blockers because that shuts off the adrenaline, by giving drugs that will block glucocorticoid receptors, that is the receptors in the brain that the cortisol acts on, or we can disconnect it by making the amygdala dysfunctional, or we can disconnect it by shutting off the connections, that is the neural connections between the amygdala and other brain regions. So that's why it took us so long to figure this out.
Yeah, I guess lots of things to do. Yeah. So are you saying, and this refers to the second word in the title of your book, emotion, that the non-emotional state is not a remembering state, or it's not a learning state.
Or not memorable.
It's a weak learning state.
So like the bored mind doesn't work. We look out into our lecture halls with these 500 people out there.
I was just going to give that as an example.
Well, maybe you do, Patrick, but the doctor doesn't.
The glaze over the eyes, the glaze over the eye is a null condition for learning. And, you know, implicitly, every good professor knows that you've got to get this system turned on. Whether they know about the system, the mechanics of it or not, that's not it. Every good lecturer knows that what you've got to do is to trip this system right. So it'll go into work, and they say, yeah, that's important.
Engage. Engagement.
Engage. Everybody knows that. And all we've done is to work out, you know, some of the details that underlie that. You know, imagine if you could sit there and every time it's an important point, you get a little squirt of adrenaline in the bloodstream. That would do it.
We could actually hook that. We could get a grant equip a whole lecture hall full of little injectors.
Cattle prods or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you let me know how it works out.
Okay. Might have a problem with the human subjects committee.
Yes. This is these drugs at their extreme doses are not good things to mess around with.
No, right, understandable.
Well, in the broadest sense, then, what does emotion have to do with memory, and what does memory have to do with emotion?
Well, you can certainly disconnect them, and the interesting thing is that in the history of memory research, they've largely been disconnected. In the case of emotional research, there's been little attention to memory until, I'd say, the last two decades. And now what we're finding is that, like the horse and carriage, you can't have one without the other. As a matter of fact, we now, in our experiments, have to go to considerable lengths. And I mean, they are really difficult experiments to do to reduce the emotional arousal that goes on when we train animals to learn. We want them to learn something with a minimum of emotional arousal so we can test the hypothesis adding emotional arousal is the critical thing.
So you have trouble keeping the emotion down.
We have trouble keeping it down. I'll give you a very specific example. There is a task that was developed about 10 years ago called object recognition for rats, and it's a very simple task. All you do is you put a rat in a box at about 18 inches by 18 inches, and there are two identical objects in it, and you allow it to explore it for a few minutes. And the next day, you put it back in the box, but one of the objects is different.
Right.
And you ask, does the animal explore the new object more than the other one? And that's evidence that it remembers what it saw the previous day. So we thought that this should be the quintessential non-emotionally arousing task because the animal is just in a box looking around.
It's so simple.
And we'll build on that then. Then we will add the emotion to it. Well, we found out, meaning a postdoc, found out that this is not a non-emotional task. And how do we know? Because the animals urinated and defecated during the first day when they were put in.
Yes.
So now in order to eliminate the emotionality, we have to put them in that box repeatedly for about a week before we give them the novel objects to explore.
To acclimate
them to that. Yeah. And then we can add our hormones and our amygdala activation and so on top of that. But before that, we weren't starting with raw stuff. We were starting already with emotionally aroused things. So think of this. A student comes in to talk about preparation of a term paper. mm-hmm. right? It's term paper, and they want to get some assignments. And so professor says, oh, yeah, it's pretty easy, you know. Here, just read this stuff and so on. What they don't know is the student is scared to death because, first yeah. of all, they're talking to a professor, and professors are different people, and they're not normal. You know, they have green ears and all of that. And besides that, they are threatened to death about writing the paper. And so you got a well-habituated person on one side for whom this is non-emotional, and you got the other one over there who's very emotional, and you don't even know if they're over the top. They may be so high in emotion that they're not going to learn anything.
And they may leave the urine and the defecation.
and they may not benefit from all of this wisdom because yes. there's a disconnect between the two. We just don't know in relating to people where they are on this scale, but it's not often that it's zero.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. James L. McGaw, research professor in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of California, Irvine. And we're talking about his new book, Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories. Dr. McGaw, we were talking about this idea of the use of your ideas about how drugs and other kinds of experiences consolidate memory. One of the things that has occurred to us recently is that students are actually picking this up and using or abusing, if you will, things like Ritalin or Dexedrine in order to prepare for exams, especially standardized exams like the SAT I'm not sure about the science of it. But the idea of it is you can increase your SAT scores by 100 points by taking some Ritalin.
Has that been proven, or is that just anecdotally out there right now?
Well, it's out there, whether it's anecdotally or not.
Well, it's being done.
Yeah, well, and it's been done for at least decades. Right. When I was an undergraduate student, amphetamines were over-the-counter.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Including drugs you could spray in your nose or you could take as a pill. And I am told that my colleagues might have taken those on occasion.
I've heard.
You've heard that.
Yeah,
yeah, you've, man, you may have
too.
Heard that.
Yeah, I have friends.
And also, caffeine is not a restricted drug as far
sure.
as I last look.
Diet pills were always big when I was in college.
Right. So that there are drugs around that certainly will influence the brain in the way that I describe. Amphetamine is one of those. Now,
yes.
Remember that in our experiments with animals and in the way we ordinarily work, that the mechanism that promotes the strengthening comes after the event. After the event. That's
yes.
where we design. You don't get a big emotional response before somebody insults you. You
mm-hmm.
get it afterwards.
Absolutely.
Right?
Right.
So the way the experiments work is the way the body works, and that is we give an experience, and this is done with humans as well, not in my laboratory but in other laboratories, give a learning experience and then follow that up with amphetamine or with cortisol or something like that, and memory for that experience is enhanced. That's quite a different story from having the stuff on board when you are going to acquire the information, because these things have other effects. Think for a moment when you're terribly embarrassed about an event that you're going to remember strongly. What do you learn while you were in that maximum state of embarrassment?
Uh-huh.
You see, that could be a bad state.
It could be,
for
indeed.
Acquiring new information. And we all know that in some sense, if we're coffee drinkers or tea drinkers, you know that beyond a certain point, the caffeine is a distractant to it. It's an irritant. The brain mm-hmm. the brain can't really work very well because it's too high, and then people will go drink a glass of milk or lie down or something like trying to get down
sure.
from the caffeine high. Well, that same thing would occur with amphetamine, Ritalin, which is a form
stimulant,
of
yeah.
stimulant like,
mm-hmm.
like amphetamine. It's the same kind of thing. So I think that students are ill-advised to think of these things as aids to study because they can't do it the way that the body does. I think that in the case of something like caffeine, if they want to have it as an aid to staying awake so they can study,
right.
then I think that would be an appropriate way to do it. But the idea that you're going to take one of these drugs and it's going to overall lift your learning ability, I'm sorry, but there's no evidence for that.
No.
Or test-taking ability. So taking it prior to taking SATs, not necessarily any benefit.
No. Now, the beta blockers are taken by performing artists because they are the drug of choice for stage fright. That's the most up until the PTSD. That was the most common off-label beta blockers, and also performing artists because it will decrease the tremolo in the voice, and it will decrease the tremolo in the violin playing when people are nervous and so on. So it is an autonomic arousal stabilizer because it prevents these kinds of things for occurring. So if the exam is singing an aria, then some musicians claim that might be a good thing to do. Not because you're going to sing that is going to improve your singing ability or your memory of the words or the tune, but simply it's going to dampen the emotional consequences that make it more difficult to do the performance.
The terror reduction.
Yeah, it's terror reduction. Stage fright, you know.
Yeah. Even though that's long after the initial event of being the first time they were afraid on stage?
Yeah, this is just an attenuation effect, much like a benzodiazepine and an anti-anxiety drug. It's just like that. So this a beta blocker does have this other effect as well, which is just to decrease the performance impairment that one finds when one has to appear in public, give a public speech, sing a song, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That has been studied. I don't know the literature of it very well. It is a commonly known. It's so commonly known that when we were with a colleague, Dr. Larry Cahill on campus, started some studies of this problem, we had to exclude performing arts students here at UCI just because we wanted to be sure that they were not taking the beta blockers on their own.
Oh, my gosh.
We never knew whether they were, but we just wanted to guard against it because we had learned that it's fairly common knowledge.
Wow. What do we not know about memory that you and others are searching for the future? What are the important topics?
Okay.
Where are you going to spend the next 40 years?
That's right.
I'm pretty well staked out. I know what I'm going to do. And also, I don't follow what other people are doing. I sort of decide what I want to do, and I'm kind of temperamental in that respect.
Yeah.
But there are some really big questions. We don't know yet, despite all of the advances in molecular biology and cellular biology, we do not yet know the cellular mechanisms that are involved when memories are formed. I mean, it's obviously a cellular process, ultimately. Nerve cells have to talk to each other in a different way as a consequence of having talked to each other. That's what it boils down to. We have a lot of hypotheses. That is, the field has a lot of hypotheses about that. It's a very, very active area of research. But we cannot tell you, this is the molecule or the set of molecules that do the job. We don't know, generally, we don't know where in the brain those processes occur for any particular kind of memory also. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult. If you want to look for the cellular biology, where do you look? I was at a conference in Germany a year or so ago with a lot of molecular biologists, and they just said, please tell us where in the brain to look so that we can go in with our molecular probes and find out what is going on. And I said, well, let me give you a little simple example. Let's put a rat in a T-shaped maze. So it runs up and it finds food at the end of the right-hand arm of the T. It's just a T. Run up the bottom of the T, turn right, and there's food over there. What does the animal learn? Well, you could say the animal has learned to turn right. Or you could say the animal has learned that food is in this place in the room. Those are very, very different implications, because if it's learned to turn right, then you'd think of one set of things in the brain, like the striatum and the cerebellum. They're very much involved in motor learning. Mm-hmm. If it's learning the place, then you'd think, well, it may well be in the parietal cortex and in the hippocampus. So where you would look depend upon what you think about the animal, think the animal has learned there. Now, the way you try to get an answer is you put the T on the other side of the top. That is, you just flip it over, put it in, start the animal from the other end, and you say, now run down, and which direction do you want to go on? If you've learned a motor skill, you will turn to the right. If mm-hmm. you've learned that it's a place, you will turn to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the test for it. And you don't know where to look unless you ask that question. So that's the beginning of sorting it out. So our job is to figure out how to interrogate animals to discover what they have learned so that we will know where to look in the brain and then what molecules to look for. And we're just beginning to do that.
Mm-hmm. How exciting. That's a wonderful line. It's just it's going to be I'd love to know it now.
Yeah, these are problems for my graduate students. And as I sometimes say, this is a wonderful field to get into.
It really is.
Because we know so little, and there is so much to be learned, and so there's room for everybody. And also, we have not been selfish in our work. We have not solved all the problems. We've left a few for the younger folks to work on, like what is the fundamental nature of memory. Notice that I've skirted this by studying the things that influence learning.
Yes.
That is working on what we call the modulatory systems. That's what I work on. And the reason I work on them, because that was something that we could do.
Yeah.
And you do what you can do. And also, it's terribly interesting, I think.
It is. And you follow it on down. But memory in the brain is all over the brain. Is
yes.
that right?
Yeah. Yes, it's all over the brain. Think about this for a moment. I say tennis. Right? Okay, now I want to remove from your brain tennis.
Got it.
Right? So I got to go and find the cell where tennis is located. Well, what do you mean where it's located? You know about tennis shoes. You know about the game of tennis. You know about the tennis racket. You may know how to play tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember that you have played tennis, and so on and so on and so on.
You remember what the ball sounds like when
that's
you hit
right.
it.
That's right. So what of that would be removed?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like untangling dried spaghetti. You know, it's not going to happen because things are so richly interconnected that there, as a matter of fact, there is no such thing as tennis in your brain. Tennis is reconstructed. When I say tennis, you reconstruct and you
bring
brain.
All of them together.
You bring them all together, and you may think of a tennis match that you played.
Yeah.
Or your muscles may be prepared to get in a receiving or a serving mode. You know, I just don't know what it does. But you're doing that.
Yes.
And that's the same for any active memory.
And it's automatic.
We have a very nice word that we don't use very much called remembering. Remembering. It's
remembering.
A very nice word. It's putting back together, because that's what memory is. It's putting back together the elements of things that we have experienced in the past to create something which we now call the representation or the memory.
Here's a little piece of my psychoanalytic interest, which is a question about the difference between conscious memory, the memory like tennis. I can bring that up in my head. It's not there all the time, but I can recall it very easily. And the part of memory that drives behavior, let's say, which is not in our conscious mind.
Well, I could extend that and say it's all unconscious at the moment. I mean, you don't know right at this time that I want to talk about the high incidence of Mercedes in Newport Beach.
Yes.
Right? And yet you immediately gathered all of that information, so you didn't think I was speaking Swahili. All of that stuff was latent. It was all back there.
Right.
Wham! It all comes up, and you have a notion of a Mercedes. And you may have been thinking of a woman, for all I know. Mercedes Smith. That's entirely possible. I have no idea. But you create that. So I would say that the distinction for me is only whether it is present or not present. But notice that it's there, and it's powerful, and can be brought and at any time, and we are limited by what we have latently there. If I should speak to you in Norwegian, it wouldn't be there.
Yeah,
there wouldn't be any unconscious memories,
for sure.
You see, which could be pulled out.
Yeah.
So I think of it as being latent or present.
Okay.
I think we need to wrap up.
I think so. And we've been talking with Dr. James L. McGaugh, research professor in the School of Biological Sciences here at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you so much for joining us in this discussion, Dr. McGaugh.
And remember, the name of the book is Memory and Emotion, the Making of Lasting Memories.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I have enjoyed our discussion.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.